on Monday, President Trump signed into law a $717 billion National Defense Authorization Act. It authorizes the policies under which funding for the military will be set by congressional appropriators. It not only includes a ton of hardware and hundreds of billions of dollars for defense contractors, but also sets out some significant changes in U.S. foreign policy. To dig into the bill, we are going to speak with William Hartung, who is our next guest. He is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. He is the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and co-editor of Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, among other books. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And good morning. So let's just start at the top. Tell us about the National Defense Authorization Act. What is it?
Well, basically, it authorizes both the money for the Pentagon, although that has to be later confirmed through the appropriations process, and a lot of policy directives about how the military and the Pentagon should operate. And so it's one of the most important pieces of legislation related to the Pentagon. It's one of the few things that actually gets finished every year. This year it was named after John McCain, although President Trump neglected to mention that and claim credit for it himself, which is not surprising. It's sort of the place where in Congress policy gets debated.
Okay, and so this authorization was for $717 billion. How much more is that than last year's authorization, and does it indicate a significant increase in military buildup as Trump pledged?
Well, in Trump's first 2 years, the Pentagon's gone up $80 billion, which is a huge amount. And this year, Congress added tens of billions of dollars more than the Pentagon even asked for. So, for example, that $80 billion in the last 2 years is twice the budget of the State Department. It's more than the entire military budget of Russia, which, of course, has been front and center in debates about U.S. Security challenges. And it's one of the highest levels since World War II. So it's a huge amount of money, much of it wasted either on bureaucratic waste, weapons we don't need, or a failed strategy.
So I'm going to want to focus on the policy changes and policy proposals next, but let's start with the hardware. What does the bill fund, and who's getting the money, meaning the defense contractors?
Well, it's, there's a lot of new money for the F-35, which my colleagues at the Project and Government Oversight have indicated is not ready for combat, the most expensive program in the history of the Pentagon. It's a jet fighter that's supposed to be used by the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines in different configurations and is being sold around the world. It's overpriced. It doesn't work in many of the aspects of what it's supposed to. And Congress authorized 77, which was a couple more than the Pentagon and Air Force requested.
Who built it?
It's Lockheed Martin with engines by Pratt & Whitney of United Technologies. Then there's the what they call the literal combat ship, which is supposed to operate close to shore. By all accounts, couldn't defend itself in a real battle. There's two extras of those. That's also a Lockheed Martin product. Another aircraft carrier at $10 to $13 billion, which is a company called Huntington Ingalls out of Virginia. A low-yield nuclear weapon, which is more likely to be used in a conflict, one of the worst ideas to come out of the nuclear priesthood in living memory. It's yet to be determined exactly how that'll go, but undoubtedly a lot of it will be the weapons labs, either Livermore in California or Los Alamos in New Mexico. And then there's tanks by General Dynamics, attack helicopters by Boeing, surveillance aircraft by Northrop Grumman, all manner of bombs made by Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing as well. And then it fully supports a $1.7 trillion 30-year buildup in nuclear weapons, bombers by Northrop Grumman, submarines by General Dynamics, a whole other range, intercontinental ballistic missiles, still to be determined who will build those. So it's mostly the big five contractors that are getting the bulk of the money up front. And those companies already get about $100 billion a year from the Pentagon. So this will just add to that. Actually, the contractors are the biggest recipients of money out of the Pentagon budget. The argument is always, well, this is for the troops. But it's really for the contractors, and it's money going into their pockets primarily in terms of that big number on the Pentagon.
Can I ask you to unpack something that's a little counterintuitive on the surface of it? Why do you describe a low-yield nuclear weapon as more dangerous?
Well, the reason they're building it, and this is, of course, this kind of Pentagonese, which a logic that doesn't always make sense to the rest of us, and rightly so. But their argument is, in a confrontation that might involve nuclear weapons, the other side might not believe that we would use our larger weapons and destroy their entire society, but that somehow if you used a lower yield nuke to quote unquote send a message, you might forestall global nuclear war. So the logic, ultimately doesn't hold up, because once you start using nuclear weapons, all bets are off. But it seems to be embedded in the minds of the war planners that they, in fact, would be more likely to use one of these things. So part of it is just the insanity of nuclear strategy. But because it's in the minds of the people who make the decisions, it does pose a higher risk.
And are these the same big five that generally get contracts? We're not seeing a shift in which military contractors are getting funding under the Trump administration versus the Obama administration or the Bush administration or the Clinton administration?
Not so far. There's some new initiatives like cybersecurity, which may benefit some smaller companies, although the big companies tend to be gobbling them up as fast as they can. There's the new Space Force, but many of the same companies are involved in missile defense and some of the other proposed projects. So far we're not seeing it. I mean, there's outrageous possibilities, like Eric Prince, the former head of Blackwater, offering to create a mercenary force to fight the war in Afghanistan or fight in Yemen. So far those have been speculative, but he is closely connected to the Trump administration.
But
so
that's not funded in this bill, and Space Force isn't funded in this bill. I can't believe I had to say Space Force. I haven't said that on the air before. I nearly started laughing at myself. Anyway, Space Force isn't funded yet, is it?
Well, no, they've got money in mind, but
right.
They're just creating it. So the bill came in too soon. So it's a lot of the elements, what will become the Space Force, are in there, but they're planning to add to that as part of this initiative.
Okay. And I just want to take a step back from what I just said. I actually don't find the Space Force humorous. There actually is a space weapons race between China and Russia, and by the president even announcing the idea of the Space Force, he enables Russia to spend money that it wants to spend on building up a militarized space zone, as does China. So it opens the door to some pretty daunting and terrifying things. We are joined by William Hartung. He is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. He's joining us from D.C. We're dissecting the National Defense Authorization Act signed by President Trump on Monday. So let's just, before we move into the policy, one more step on the weaponry. So you say, that the bills are discussed as something for the troops, but they're really for the contractors. But of course, the weapons that the contractors build are used by the troops. To what extent do you think the weaponry in this authorization is unnecessary, redundant, excessive, not something that will protect the troops protecting themselves?
Well, I think there's two elements. One is, threatening nuclear annihilation helps no one, certainly not the troops. A lot of the weapons are not likely to work as well as existing systems, like the F-35, for example. The real problem and the real threat to our troops is our global military strategy. We're involved in 7 wars currently. We deploy special forces to about 140 countries every year. We have more than 800 global military bases. We have aircraft carriers all over the globe. And, if you're postured to go anywhere, fight any battle, have this global military presence and a policy of perpetual war, you're risking lives of troops. Of course, we've had huge, not only deaths in these conflicts, but also people coming back with post-traumatic stress syndrome and major brain injuries and loss of limbs and so forth. And that's going to be a huge cost to the society, which, of course, we must pay going forward. So I think it's a combination of the strategy that this bill kind of reinforces and authorizes, and also that a lot of the systems, in fact, are not going to be the most useful things for people who have been put into these wars.
Okay. So let's look at where some changes in policy are happening with this funding. So one thing that raised concern to me in reading it was that the bill includes $6.3 billion in funding for the presence of U.S. troops in Europe, the largest amount of money spent on U.S. troops in Europe since the Cold War. The bill also moves the Europe-based troops one step closer to permanent deployment. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's a return to the Cold War policy. There used to be many more troops in Europe prior to the end of the Cold War, so it's a movement in the wrong direction. It'll heighten tensions with Russia, of course. And to the extent that there's an issue with Russia, they're not going to roll tanks into Eastern Central Europe or anywhere else. Whereas, in a worst case, perhaps there'd be cyber attacks. Of course, they've connected with right-wing movements in Europe and so forth. Nothing that really is going to be changed by putting more U.S. troops there in terms of actually protecting anyone. But I think it will heighten tensions with Russia, which could lead to all kinds of negative consequences.
There is this sense that one of the things the Trump administration is doing is allowing the Russians to also build up their military. That is a consequence of the Space Force announcement. It also seems to be a consequence of this military buildup. That it goes without question that it would permit, were the Russians to want to do so, to build up their own military and increase their own military spending and increase their own military presence, which is obviously something that Putin likes. He likes to look strong and emboldened and, you know, muscular and militarized is one of the ways of doing that.
Yes, it's sort of a classic arms race scenario. And so rather than coming to some accommodation or trying to hold the line on existing arms control agreements that would do things like limit troops in Europe and limit the number of nuclear weapons and so forth, the Trump administration is ignoring all of that. And so, what they're presenting as a defense strategy is more likely to make matters worse.
Okay, let's go on to North Korea and South Korea. Of course, President Trump had a big event with the North Koreans, creating a path supposedly towards peace. And one of those things was reducing a commitment to reduce troop numbers. But the bill prohibits the Pentagon from reducing troop numbers in South Korea below $22,000 unless the Secretary of Defense certifies it's in America's national security interest. Is that significant?
Well, I think it is, just in the sense that there's this kind of hawkish attitude towards North Korea that's not conducive to negotiations. And, of course, the leadership here, which is rarely mentioned in the U.S. press, is from the South Korean president. And recently, the North and the South have said they would like a peace treaty to end the Korean War, which never was signed. And the U.S. has been the obstacle to doing that. So down the road, were there a peace treaty, were there closer relations between North and South Korea, the South Koreans themselves might want to see a reduction or elimination of U.S. troops. That's not in the cards at the moment, but I think this, you know, call by Congress is kind of the wrong signal at this moment in time. I mean, there should be support for the idea of diplomacy, even if it's Trump. I mean, if there's some way in which they could reduce tensions, having talks, whatever the outcome, is far better than threats of nuclear war, which, of course, we've heard from Trump in the recent past.
It did look like there were some good measures in there regarding Saudi Arabia and Yemen and restricting in-flight refueling for Saudi-led coalition flights over Yemen, requiring some other pieces regarding oversight over U.S. activities in Yemen. What do you think about those provisions, and can you describe them in better detail than I just did?
I think they're very important. There's been members like Ro Khanna and Ted Lieu from California, Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, Bernie Sanders, even some conservatives like Mike Lee from Utah, who've questioned this whole war on constitutional grounds, the U.S. support for the Saudi intervention in Yemen. So one amendment would require the Pentagon to investigate the role of U.S. troops in torture that's being carried out by our UAE allies in Yemen. The AP and Human Rights Watch exposed a series of secret prisons in Yemen, which have been used to engage in the most brutal acts of torture. And there's some question whether the U.S. has been benefiting from that torture in terms of intelligence, or if there's any other kind of involvement. The Pentagon is kind of stonewalled into whether they've done a thorough investigation of that. And then there's an amendment, as you referred to, would condition refueling of Saudi aircraft, which is an important part of allowing them to do all these airstrikes, many of which have killed civilians, unless there's can be certified they're making good faith efforts to end the war, the reason the blockade, which has affected millions of people, they're making clear efforts to reduce civilian casualties. So it's calling on the State Department to do this, otherwise the refueling aid would be rescinded. So it's another step in a series of things that Congress had tried to do to disengage the U.S. from that war. There's going to be a vote sometime soon on a new tranche of guided bombs that the U.S. wants to sell to Saudi Arabia, which is directly relevant to the war. Last time Trump tried to do that, there were 47 votes against it in the Senate. So there's some hope that that kind of initiative could be defeated. And Senator Bob Menendez of the Foreign Relations Committee has currently put a hold on that deal, which is kind of a customary thing, which if the administration wanted, they could just ignore it and blow through. But if they did so, they could lose some votes. And it's a very tight vote count at this point. So I think Congress, you know, pushed by groups like Women Without War and Friends Committee on National Legislation and Oxfam, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and others, has stepped up considerably in opposing the U.S. involvement, supporting the Saudis in Yemen, which is certainly not the case in many of the other wars that the U.S. is involved in.
Who's pushing that within Congress? Like, who is getting traction on measures that would rein in weapon sales to Saudi Arabia?
Well, Ro Khanna has done a couple things. He did this torture amendment that I mentioned. He also attempted to bring a war powers resolution action in the House, which leadership pushed aside. But basically, that would have said this is an unauthorized war and we have to stop our logistical support for the Saudis. On the Senate side, Bernie Sanders and Mike Lee of Utah did a similar measure that got 44 votes. People like Chris Murphy have had a direct role in pushing against the arms sales that we've gotten, you know, significant numbers.
Yeah, no, I get that. So, but you're naming Democrats in the most progressive parts of the country, and clearly they wouldn't be getting these measures through without some Republican support. So, like, where are they picking that up from, and why are those people crossing over?
Well, Mike Lee from Utah, who I mentioned, is opposing it on constitutional grounds. He thinks Congress should authorize any kind of involvement in wars. The senator from Indiana, whose name is escaping me at the moment, Todd, it'll come to me. But anyway, he, on humanitarian grounds, has opposed a lot of the U.S. involvement in Yemen. So it's a combination of the fact that this is such a horrific humanitarian catastrophe that even some Republicans who normally wouldn't engage against their administration are doing so, and this constitutional argument. So, I think they picked up five or six Republicans on the vote against the bombs. Unfortunately, they lost some Democrats, many of them from states that have large presence of defense industries. But if they could keep the Democrats on board and hold on to the five or six Republicans, they could block the next deal.
Bill, in just our last minute or so, and again, this is William Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. What about Iran?
Well, Iran has been blamed for, you know, much of the trouble in the Middle East, and in an exaggerated fashion. It's kind of like, you know, Pentagon doesn't have Russia as an enemy to point to. They don't have sort of big reasons to justify their military presence. So Iran has become sort of the demon of the moment. And in Yemen in particular, their role is fairly limited. The Houthi, who are fighting the Saudis in the UAE, have their own longstanding grievances, which they've been fighting over for years. And Iran has given them small amounts of support. But but they're hardly puppets of Iran, and they're going to fight whether Iran supports them or not. And of course, the few missiles that they've lobbed towards Saudi Arabia pale in comparison to the Saudis.
But let me, sorry to interrupt you because we're running out of time, but in the authorization, is there anything in the Authorization Act that reasserts what seems to be a trajectory that the Trump administration is on for military conflict with Iran?
I haven't seen that in the final. It may be in there, but certainly Congress, Republicans and Democrats have taken a hawkish attitude towards Iran, although there's been some people saying, look, war with Iran should be off the table. So it's a mix in Congress. But were Trump to go forward, my concern is whether Congress would speak up loudly enough, either against a invasion, a bombing, regime change through manipulating internal groups, whatever the administration chooses to do. We have to be alert. We're in kind of that pre-Iraq phase where things could get out of hand quickly.
All right. Well, thank you for that warning, and thank you for being with us this morning. Our guest is William Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you.